Anyway, thank you very, very much indeed, Mark, but obviously with some trepidation, I must say, in front of this particular company today, for certainly I've got no competence whatsoever. Frankly, who has any competence to talk about this wonderful material at all, which makes one really very, very modest and very humble. We were all fantastically overcome yesterday, I think, by the showing of the complete Superbeg film, which is what I'm going to be talking about. There will, in the course of this, be three video clips, but I'm afraid you'll have to be a little bit patient because they come some time in. But as I was saying, I've really got no competence in the Freudian or any other kind of psychology. I mean, as a student some years ago, I did read many of the classic Freudian texts and thought they were rather like detective stories, absolutely wonderful. But I'm afraid over a lifetime I've absorbed too little of them, maybe repressed too much. Anyway, I must ask for your understanding that I'm going to largely follow Hans-Jürgen Superberg's own Jungian view of his extraordinarily wonderful film version of Parsifal. Its central unifying image, as you'll recall, and on which the action takes place, is that of the physiognomy, even the very skull of the Wagnerian mind in which it was conceived. The huge studio mock-up of Wagner's death mask was about 15 metres long and about 9 metres wide. I think it's important to begin by recognising that Superberg's Parsifal film is in fact the culmination of quite a series of previous films with which he'd sought to exorcise the association between icons of German culture and their debasement by the Third Reich. Superbeg was born in 1935. I think he's just celebrated his 80th birthday and he's very alive and well. He'd spent his childhood on his father's estate in Pomerania, in eastern Germany. And in 1953, he moved from east to west Germany, did some work with Brecht. And between 1963 and 1965, he actually made more than about 80 short television films. And then, in 1972, came Ludwig, Requiem for a Virgin King, which marked the beginning of a fascination with Wagner that was to become ever more obsessive for Superbeg. In the Ludwig film, he presents both King Ludwig and Wagner as incarnations of the romantic German spirit who've been scandalously betrayed by political appropriation and latterly by commercial exploitation. And those who've done this have considered Ludwig and Wagner's mystique, their irrationalism, as a dangerous phenomenon, a threat to the order of the modern democratic state. In the film, Superbeg's Wagner protests he was always a revolutionary and the creator of the protest music of the 19th century. This film was followed by a study of another source of escapist fantasy, Karl May, little known in this country. But May was the author of hugely popular Wild West adventure stories, and they were much admired by Hitler, who, passing over the writer's rather inconvenient pacifism, allegedly commended the stories to his generals as a recipe for victory at Stalingrad. This would be a bit like Churchill commending Biggles as an exemplar to his generals. Superbeg next sought to substantiate his interest in Wagner as a mythographer of the modern German soul. And he did this by persuading Wagner's daughter-in-law, Winifred, widow of Siegfried Wagner, to talk on camera about her infatuation with Hitler and his role in the Bayreuth of the 1930s. Here at last, in 1975, Superbeg had found a key player who was prepared to give an unapologetic account of Bayreuth in the Third Reich. But for Winifred's son, Wolfgang Wagner, who'd striven since 1951 to keep the skeletons in the cupboard, this was a disaster. Winifred's confessions came out on German television and all over the place just as Wolfgang was preparing to consolidate Bayreuth as an international rather than a Germanic phenomenon. And he'd done this quite scandalously to many of his countrymen by inviting the French team of Pierre Boulez and Patrice Chéreau to stage The Ring, the most quintessentially German work of all, in 1976, its centennial year. At the end of the Winifred film, Superberg inserts a small shot of himself with the caption, "This film is part of Hans-Jürgen Superberg's Trauerarbeit." Trauerarbeit. It's his first use of the word, and it literally means, of course, work of mourning. It's a concept originally derived, as many of you know, from Freud's 1915 essay, Trauer und Melancholie, in which Freud argues that the individual can overcome the loss of a loved person only by doing Trauerarbeit, by undergoing a repeated, painful process of remembering. The Trauerarbeit continues with Hitler, a film from Germany, an immensely long cinematic essay. It's actually about nearly 7 hours, 7 hours, about the Führer's hold over Germany. And this film is at once an interrogation of the past and a castigation of the present. The story unfolds in an elaborate collage of quotation and allusion. Historic footage of Hitler is juxtaposed with images of a young girl, actually Superberg's 9-year-old daughter, Amelie, attempting to bring under control her puppet dolls of Hitler and his cronies. At the very end, music from Fidelio signals the dawn of freedom, but it's not a prospect that the little girl is ready to face. She folds her hands in prayer, covers her ears, closes her eyes, as though to blot out the nightmare landscape. She's been through the world, but hasn't been able to find the way back to paradise. Well, this film echoes a favourite theme of Thomas Mann's, namely that Hitler was a pathological miscarriage of the artistic impulse, an instance of the evil that results when the dreams of art are translated into real-life politics. Superberg's Hitler is everywhere enthralled to the influence that Wagner had had on the Nazis. In the Ludwig and Hitler films, Superberg had been mesmerised by Wagner's catastrophic hold over two very different kinds of romantic dreamer. But the result of his interviews with Winifred Wagner was to make Superberg think that perhaps Wagner was more sinned against than sinning. And so he thought he'd make a film to rescue him, his Parsifal, a film of the opera in which the composer most intimately confronts himself and his art. After the confessions of Winifred, why not the confessions of Richard in the shape of a version of his last opera? In the Parsifal film, Superberg's quest is to rediscover the dream of a redemptive grail. The sins and wounds of Klingsor, Kundry and Amfortas are identified with those of Wagner himself. But no less of the Germany that gave rise to Hitler and would not take proper steps to bury him. And so this would be a film that rejected Wagner's pictorial scenario in favour of a psychological exploration of the opera, of its roots in Wagner's mind and of its historical afterlife. The opera would be reborn in the light of its relationship with its creator and, no less, with history and its history. And so it was that Sueberg got this brilliant idea of locating the events on or around or even in a huge model of the composer's death mask. The mask is but seldom seen in its entirety, the individual scenes taking place in appropriate parts of its physiognomy. At the beginning, when fanfares herald the dawning day, the Graalsburg that is revealed is that of Wagner's own head, with behind it a projection of Caspar David Friedrich's Kreuz im Gebirge, the cross in the mountains, one of the most famous images of German Romanticism. A cornucopia of such projected quotations is found throughout the film. At first seen like a witch flying on a horse model as used for the Valkyries in 19th century Bayreuth, Kundry soon emerges from a pool that's later revealed as the socket of Wagner's eye. The complete score of Parsifal was recorded, of course, before filming began. The conductor was Armin Jourdan with the Orchestra Philharmonique de Monte Carlo. And with the exceptions of Alger Haugland as Klingsor and Robert Lloyd, who is so happily with us here today and will be talking with me afterwards as Gurnemanz, the roles are all played by actors who mime to the pre-recorded voices of Wolfgang Schirner as Amfortas, Hans Chalmer as Tintorel, Rainer Goldberg as Parsifal, and Yvonne Minton as Kundry. While Amfortas is actually acted by the conductor himself, Armin Jourdan. It's characteristic of Sueberg's imagery in the film that the Amfortas wound is treated as representative of a whole array of other wounds. Abstracted from Amfortas's body, his wound is on public view as a suppurating pathological exhibit carried about on a cushion by female pages. I suppose you might be tempted to call them Wundermädchen. It's at once a symbol, I am sorry for that, especially to my German friends. It's at once a symbol of a mortally ill monarchy and an object of public shame. It's Germany's unassuaged shame and guilt, an object of fascination and horror until it can be healed. Behind Tintorel, as he lies down to die in his living tomb beneath the throne of Amfortas, are photo projections that are supposedly of war wounded awaiting attention in a field hospital. For this is indeed a film that gathers wounds as it rolls, and they bleed for mankind and for everything that needs to be healed. The images of the Grail are similarly varied. They include projections of Paul Joukowsky's 1882 Grail Temple, which is also shown in ruined form, and a huge crystal which girls load onto a trolley and bring into the temple. Someone, Barry Millington reminds me that somebody suggested that this huge crystal may be at the heart in Mecca, the great object of the pilgrimage, of Islamic pilgrimage, is actually some sort of stone that I think came down from heaven or was brought down from heaven. I'm not sure whether this is right or not, but it's an interesting idea. During the closing bars of the opera, the Grail actually becomes a model of the Festspielhaus in Bayreuth itself. Cradled in Kundry's arms, it's intended to signify a Bayreuth at last redeemed from misinterpretation, from its guilt, and from its ghosts. Because the opera is imagined as a psychodrama where time has become space, Robert Lloyd's clean-shaven, youthful Gurnemanz does not visibly age between the first and the third acts. And doubtless that's something that we'll be able to talk about a little later. Superberg isn't the first director to have been so mesmerised by Kundry that the opera becomes more the story of her redemption than that of Amfortas. She, as brilliantly acted by Edith Klaver, but of course sung by Yvonne Minton, and Amfortas, they are conceived by Superberg as the female and male halves of a single suffering self. They're bound together by her enforced seduction of him and the wounds thereby inflicted on them both. Both are Klingsor's victims. And that's something, obviously, that Berlin production very interestingly plugged into with that great kiss they had at the end. And this pairing balances that of the two Parsifals, one male, representing Jung's animus, and yes, the other female. She was on the rather nice shot, the rather nice sort of title slide. Yes, on the left is the female Parsifal, of whom more along, and of course she represents the animal. We are, yes, in Jungian territory still. At the end of the prelude, the camera closes in on the boy and girl Parsifals, wrapped closely together in silent communion. Then the luxuriantly shock-headed boy gently breaks free and departs. He leaves his female counterpart behind to dream. Superberg's idea is that while one Parsifal dreams, the other enacts the dream. And then the roles are reversed at the point of Kundry's kiss, after which it's now the boy who dreams while the action is taken over by the girl. Now the boy Parsifal, of course, he remains innocent of his sexuality until Kundry reawakens memories of his mother Herzelida. As she tells Parsifal the story of his birth, Kundry becomes Herzelida. And in the film, she cradles in her arms a puppet of the child Parsifal who'd been glimpsed at the very beginning of the film. Superberg exploits to the full the ambivalence of Wagner's characteristic association of erotic love with love of the mother. The pivotal moment comes when Kundry's kiss simultaneously awakens his sexuality and overwhelming feelings of shame and guilt. Breaking free from her with the cry, Amfortas, die Wunder, his place is taken by the girl, who's quietly slipped forward from underneath a projection of the death mask. And the boy briefly joins his voice with hers before he dissolves into soft focus and disappears. Let us see the moment from the film. Thank you. It's this rather lovely, serious girl, Parsifal. It's she who sets off on the long restitutional journey back to the Grail. And in Act 3, of course, it's she in her leather helmet and jerkin who's rapturously received by Gwynemunce and Kundry. Superberg handles the Good Friday scene with immense tenderness as Kundry and Parsifal look into each other's eyes. For the director, this scene was of central significance in his project to cleanse and redeem Wagner for his sins and for those sins trespassed against him by the Third Reich. And indeed, doesn't this chime precisely with Gornemann's "Thus all creation gives thanks for everything that blossoms and soon dies. Absolved from sin, nature regains its state of innocence." As the bells begin to toll, the figures advance towards the camera and disappear out of focus. back to the beginning. Yeah, well, as I say with the Wagner opera, don't worry if you fall asleep when you wake up, it'll still be going on, maybe coming round again. But I'd like to insert a slightly irreverent but rather nice note. Tom DeRose, who played such an important part in setting up this conference and who talked to us, he had a lot of correspondence by email with Super himself, was very sorry he couldn't come. However, in one email from Superberg himself to... Yes, it's coming, I'm afraid. Superberg, in an email to Tom Rose, actually talked about Parsifal bending to kiss Kundry on the foreskin.
Greatest Freudian slips.
Anyway,
well, I wasn't going to mention that.
No, but Tom, you set it up. How did you chose this? Couldn't avoid it. Back in the Hall of the Grail, in the foreground, Amfortas is already lying on his deathbed. The bleeding open wound lies on a cushion alongside him in the foreground. Such is his agony that he cries out to the knights to plunge their swords into him. And at this critical moment, the girl Parsifal appears high up at the top of the skull and bearing, not a spear, but a crucifix. She's still but the harbinger of the missing spear. Nur eine Waffe taugt, only one weapon will serve, she sings. And then, below her, and finding his way through the knights, the boy Parsifal reappears with the necessary spear. Den heiligen Speer ich bring ihn euch zurück. The holy spear, I bring it back to you. And the girl joins him, and they sing together of the healing of the wound. Amfortas and Kundry are absolved and released to die alongside each other. Without any help from a stab in the back from Gornimath's doubtless disapproving, who knows. Finally, as the Parsifals command, Enthüllet den Graal, öffnet den Schrein, uncover the Grail, open the shrine. The shrine, which of course here is also Wagner's head, seen in profile, it begins to split apart. And the mists roll in, perhaps to suggest that it's now above the clouds. And in its cleft appear together both Parsifals, who gently embrace. For Superberg, this is a resolution of the split consciousness seen in the two Parsifals, the animus and anima, now healed and whole at last.
Waffe auf eure Schilde.
Nietzsche's eternal recurrence yet again. Sorry to have to break off there. Well, what are we to make of this wonderful film? How far do we think that Superberg actually succeeded in his mission to use Parsifal, firstly, as an instrument to probe Wagner's mind, and secondly, as a critique of 20th century Germany? A massive problem is that the film, like Parsifal itself, is so rich, so multi-layered, and resonant in its imagery. Perhaps we should first question Superberg's brilliant, macabre, and disturbing strategy of locating the work on, in, and around this huge studio mock-up of Wagner's head. The premise would appear to be, come on, we're not fooled, the opera is primarily about your secret self, Wagner. It's a summation, a valedictory confession, an exercise in self-analysis on the grandest, most profound scale. And of course, you are Amfortas, and his wound is your wound. You're also Parsifal, struggling with sexual temptation, anxiety, and guilt. And no less, you are Kundry, in thrall to the forces of good and evil. You're in search also, of course, of a holy grail of forgiveness, resolution, redemption. Well, I suspect that actually, does this really tell us anything very new about Wagner's psychology or about his creative processes? Isn't it indulging the romantic fallacy of urging the identity of the work of art on its creator? What is immortal about Wagner isn't that it's an expression of Wagner, rather that the work has transmuted the writhing energies of Wagner's inchoate unconscious into a great work of universal art, rooted not in an individual mind that created it, but in Jung's collective unconscious. This isn't to deny the brilliance of using Wagner's physiognomy as a setting. In essence, of course, it's a psychological ploy, positing that the characters in the opera are actually but the constituents of a single psyche. This was also the idea behind Robert Donington's well-known Jungian analysis of the ring. Wagner's characters become perhaps less important as flesh and blood people than as symbols, as dream images enacting dramas buried deep within the psyche. If you can accept this, then you'll have few problems with much that may otherwise seem obscure and even perverse in the film. Of course, it's also fair to wonder whether the plethora of imagery in the film isn't excessive, even perhaps sometimes mischievously obscurantist. Well, I guess Superberg himself would probably retort that the very stuff of dreams is the irrationality of its imagery. Let each one make of it what he may. And there's no question that for Superberg himself, the magician, the Zauberer who's conjured it all up, nothing is arbitrary and without significance. It's just that sometimes for us it can only be decoded with effort. And Superberg could argue that the obscurities are actually a deliberate strategy to appeal to vex and agitate the viewer's own unconscious rather than to satisfy and flatter his rational response. Because Superberg had, I think, hit the spot so precisely, politically speaking, the film had a very frosty reception in both Germanies. He was accused, among other things, of dallying with fascism, of being complicit with the very evil he seemed to be seeking to expiate. The wider cause of Trauerarbeit, of mourning, in both Germanies remained really pretty much untouched by his Parsifal. And it was only really abroad, most noticeably in France, England and America, that the film was hailed as a telling analysis of Germany's problematic attitude to its past. A much more difficult question, but obviously one of great importance in our context today, is whether Superberg's foray into psychoanalysis, does it hold water? Is it helpful that he should have split his Parsifal into a male consciousness, which hands over the completion of an integrated self to a complementary female consciousness. Are Oedipal and castration anxieties really at the heart of the drama? The male fear of female sexuality? And what of Superberg's treatments of the intertwined duality and ambivalence of Kundry? Titura as Amfortas's superego, Klingsel as his dark psychic counterpart? These are questions to which, really, I've no competence whatsoever, really, to suggest answers, but I know there are many of you here in this room who will be able to do so, and I hope I've said enough to have stimulated you to enter the fray. One final thought. I'm lamentably culpable in having failed to say anything about what surely the most powerful psychoanalytic agent of all in Parsifal. Not Superberg's Parsifal, but Wagner's. And of course I mean the music, because it's Wagner's unparalleled deployment of a leitmotivic technique of musical association, of memory, of reminiscence, which is of extraordinary harmonic richness and complexity. It's this, really, which announces Wagner as a dramatic psychologist without equal. In 1933, a year of some significance for Superberg, this was well recognised by Thomas Mann when he remarked, and I quote, "The most extraordinary intuitive affinity between Wagner the psychologist and that other characteristic son of the 19th century, the psychoanalyst Sigmund Freud." Mann writes of all this brilliantly, and I leave you with one other quote. "The way that Siegfried's thoughts of his mother slide into eroticism in his reverie beneath the linden tree, or the way in which, in the scene where Mima tries to instruct his ward in the meaning of fear, the motif of Brynhilde slumbering in the fire moves through the orchestra like a dark, distorted presence. This, says Mann, is pure Freud, pure psychoanalysis. Shouldn't we indeed, don't we have reason to speak of the couch ringed by flame?" To cite but one very, very simple instance in Parsifal of the music, and this is my very last thought. Immediately after Kundry's narration of his mother's death has awoken Parsifal's sympathy with pain and suffering, his cry of "Wehe, wehe, was tat ich, wo war ich, wo is me, alas, what have I done, where was I?" His vocal line is almost identical with that of Amfortas's agonized response to Titurel in Act 1. "Wehe, wehe mir der Qual, alas, woe is me for my pain." And so this momentary musical association of Parsifal with Amfortas, it prefigures, in fact, the entire dramatic course of the scene. For it's Kundry's kiss, of course, who will set off Parsifal's transformation and his empathetic identification with Amfortas. But convinced, as I think we must surely be, by music's psychoanalytic potency, how do we begin to talk about it, other than in metaphoric terms? It's a question for another day. Thank you.